In the beginning of the series, we talked about that a disciple would answer his call, and we talked about how he calls all of us in his love. And then last week, we talked about that they would know that we are his disciples by our love for one another and our love for our enemies. And today, we're going to talk about how a disciple responds to the needs that we see out there. Pastor Tan read a prophecy from Isaiah. Here's another one. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. So we know this is a prophecy about the Messiah, and Matthew quotes this verse and applies it to Jesus himself. What does this verse mean? Well, first, if you know anything about a reed, it's a hollow stem plant that you find in marshy areas. But because it's hollow, it's not the hardiest of plants. If you stepped on one, it would most likely be crushed and break. And so because of that, the picture or the image is of vulnerability. How many of us can relate to being bruised and bent by life? And when you've been bruised, even the slightest hurt in that area, when you've already been hurt, takes you back to that really bad place. Well, the other image there is the image of a smoldering wick. Now, a lamp doesn't smoke or smolder until the lamp is nearly out of oil. This is also a picture of vulnerability. This could be a description of someone who feels empty. Maybe you're out of money or out of energy or out of faith or even out of hope. That your life is smoldering because so much has been taken and so little given back in return. Some people today listening may feel like a smoldering wick. So in both of these pictures, Isaiah is saying that the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, he will be coming to minister to those kinds of people, those who are vulnerable. He has a compassion for those who have been bruised. He didn't come to contribute to your pain. Instead, he comes to heal. Jesus didn't come to deplete you. Instead, he came to fill you. And the Bible says he binds up the brokenhearted. And it says he heals our wounds. So let's look at this prophecy, both parts of that prophecy. The first is the smoldering wick. And let's talk about Jesus and the downtrodden. That Jesus models for us what he wants us to become. In Matthew chapter 21, it says, Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. The blind and the lame came to him at the temple, and he healed them. If you're watching or present Wednesday night, you know, Pastor Malcolm, they were talking about this very incident that's recorded in all four Gospels. And this passage shows us God's heart towards people who've been taken advantage of. These people are like the smoldering wick. They're empty. They most likely have lost their land, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But Jesus responds with appropriate action. He addresses something that's a problem even today. And I call this subpoint prophets for profit. You will hear me often criticize those televangelists, those prosperity theologians. You can't even really hardly call them theologians, can you, Malcolm? That they're really there to make a buck off of you. Well, back then, the office of the high priest actually became a Roman appointment of all things. And that role was given to the highest bidder. So the temple itself became a racket, including the buying and the selling of sacrificial animals. Also the exchange of foreign currency in order to pay this temple tax that was required. And so this is why Jesus said it was a den of robbers. How did they rob people? Well, one way is that they overcharge for sacrifices. Alfred Edersheim, in his book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, said they would exploit the worshipers. And those who sold pigeons would do likewise, charging perhaps $4 for a pair of doves worth a nickel. You see, the reason Matthew's gospel points out doves in particular is because doves were the offering of the poorest of the poor. Now, in today's day and age, we might get used to sort of being taken advantage of. You might go to a Cowboys game and pay $25 for a hot dog, right? But we're kind of used to that. But we would expect God's people to be a little different. Let's say you lived back then and you decided to get around the corruption by bringing your own animal from your home. Well, all the animals had to pass inspection, and guess what? None of them ever did. Another way they were robbing people was through the currency exchange. All the people between 20 and 50 years old had to pay a temple tax. The problem is that it couldn't be paid in Roman currency because it had Caesar Divi F, which was short for Caesar Divi Filius. And you can see the picture of that coin from back then. That means Caesar, son of God. So, of course, this statement was blasphemous, so they couldn't use that particular money in the temple tax, and so they would exchange it. They had found coins from the coastal city of Tyre, which didn't have this particular blasphemous statement, and they would exchange it for a 25% surcharge. All this did was put more money in the pocket of the high priest and those who worked for him. So in today's dollars, some scholars have estimated that the temple took in $170 million a year. The high priest would use most of that money to loan out as sort of a loan shark to further take advantage of the poor. And because the rates were impossible to pay, it just became a ruse for a massive land grab. Then the farmers would actually then become sharecroppers for the high priest. N.T. Wright said, when the revolutionaries took over the temple at the start of the war, one of the first acts was to burn the records of debts. Now remember, Jesus was the fulfillment of Jubilee, where Jubilee, part of Jubilee was to forgive debts every 50 years, and they never practiced it. So Jesus became the fulfillment of that. So when he saw all of this going on, he took action. He drove out the animals with a whip fashioned out of cords. Now some people think that Jesus used a whip on people. Those people that think that have not actually read the story. The antecedent of the word them is not people, but the animals. By the way, in John's account, there's another cleansing of the temple at the beginning of his ministry. And so we see that this wasn't something that was only done once, that Jesus had to take action twice in his ministry. The word used to describe Jesus driving out the money changers in the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Luke, that word is the word for exorcism. So he's literally driving out the demons of greed and exploitation. Can you imagine? The one place where someone could go back then to seek the Lord was the one place that they would get taken advantage of. And I think that countless people over the years have turned their back on God because people representing God took advantage of them. That's what made Jesus angry. Have you ever heard this statement? If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Well, that applies in this situation. Notice Jesus understood the depravity of the culture, but reserved his anger for those representing God. And so we have to be careful not to do the opposite, indict culture and then excuse our own. To put a barrier between anyone seeking the Lord is the opposite of what we're called to do as his disciples. Mark 11:17, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. In fact, when the high priest set up these bazaars of animals to be sold, they were set up in the court of the Gentiles. And so if a Gentile, who was obviously an outsider, came to seek God at the temple, by design, there would be no room for them to worship because the animals took up all of the room in the court of the Gentiles. And what Jesus reminded them of, we have to remind ourselves of in the same way often, that his house would be called a house of prayer for what? All the nations. That the church should not miss this command, that we are called to reach all people. And so when sometimes people will say, well, why do we send so much money overseas? Because there's a lot of lost people overseas. We spend a lot of money here in Granbury and in the state of Texas and in the United States. But we are to go after all people with the gospel message. So let's take a closer look at Jesus' passion. First of all, he had this fiery anger that was directed towards those who were fleecing the flock. He's angry that people are being used, but he's most angry at the name of God being dishonored. But his anger is appropriate. And this is where I think many of us sort of confuse our own anger. We often think that we are more like Jesus driving out the money changers in the temple. But But we have to look at his anger in particular. It was directed in the right way. See, we often get angry at the wrong people for the wrong reasons, don't we? Which is why James chapter 1 verse 20 warns that our anger does not produce the righteousness of God. But his anger is so much different than that. In fact, look at this next point, his gentle compassion. It's powerful, and I think this is the most powerful part of this story, to see that on the heels of Jesus' anger, the lame and the blind flocked to him. When's the last time you were drawn to an angry person? Like never, right? So you see, there's something very different about that. Because the lame, the blind, and the broken, they know and understand that the anger is not directed at them, it's directed for them. He's exorcising the evil from the temple. And as disciples, we are called to do exactly the same thing. People need to know that God's people are their ally, and a church cannot be called a church if all are not welcome. Especially the smoldering wicks. Well, let's look at the other side of Isaiah's prophecy, the bruised reed. And this is about Jesus and the broken. And I think the best story to illustrate that comes from John chapter 4. Let's start reading in verse 4. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with the Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." So we're very familiar with the story, but the story begins where Jesus is in Judea and he's headed to Galilee. And the region between those two places is called Samaria. And when the Jews would travel between those two places, Judea and Galilee, they would actually cross the Jordan River twice to specifically go out of their way to avoid Samaria. So you see, the shortest distance between two points, it's pretty obvious to most of us who had ninth grade math, right? But they go out of their way just to avoid that area. So there must be some really juicy gossip or context to this, and that's what I'm going to give to you. By the way, that phrase Jesus had to go through Samaria, that "have to" is related to the conversation that he's going to have with this woman. So let's get to the historical context. The Samaritans were descendants of the Jews who had remained in Palestine after the Assyrians had defeated Israel. So they are the result of Jews and Assyrians intermarrying years and years before. And so because of that, they were despised by the Jews. Listen to this scholar talk about this particular hatred. "Samaritans," she said, "were regarded as heretics and unclean by the Jews. Jews would ordinarily avoid handling any vessel or utensil touched by a Samaritan. Certainly, Jews would not want to drink from a cup offered by a Samaritan." Thus, the woman asks sarcastically, "How can you, a Jew, ask me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink?" So the woman at the well understood all of this hatred between the Jews and the Samaritans. The Samaritans would say, "Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they all lived in the north where we live. The shrines of Bethel, Shechem, and Mount Gerizim are all spiritual places in our history." And it was the northern part of the kingdom that resisted the monarchy. Remember in the Old Testament how God told them not to ask for a king because it would not be in their best interest? And sure enough, God was right. And the Samaritan said, "Hey, we knew that was a bad idea all along." And so they considered themselves a purer faith than the Jews. And so you can imagine, this created all kinds of bad blood on Facebook, right? So, if you read Ezra and Nehemiah, you will also read about the return of the Jews to their homeland after years of captivity, and they rebuild the temple and the wall in Jerusalem, and at first the Samaritans greet them and offer assistance in the building, but Nehemiah refuses their help, and then the Samaritans started to actively oppose their rebuilding efforts, and that's when the Samaritans built their own temple on Mount Gerizim. Well, about 128 B.C., some Jewish zealots attacked that very temple on Mount Gerizim and destroyed it. So fast forward, by the time we get to the time of Jesus, the Samaritans were getting their revenge by making regular attacks on the temple in Jerusalem. They didn't come to destroy it, though, but they tried to desecrate it by bringing human bones into the courtyard. So Jewish people would only even use the word Samaritan as a curse word. This was a typical morning prayer of a Jewish person. Lord, give me a good day. Give me this day my daily bread. Keep me safe today. Lord, I pray that there will be no Samaritans in the resurrection on the last day. That'll tell you how they felt about him. And then Jesus, in John chapter 8, verse 48, is called by this Jewish group of people, they called him a demon-possessed Samaritan. That was the worst insult that they could think of. Now, with all of that background and that context, let's go back to the conversation between Jesus and the woman. He does what no Jewish man would ever do, and that's speak to a woman in public. But he's also a rabbi, and it was said by rabbis, it is better for the Torah to be burned than to be taught to a woman, which again shows us how radical Jesus was when he allowed Mary to sit at his feet. And so many other examples as well. So there are already all these barriers, but Jesus speaks to her anyway. He has this theological conversation with her, but what's most fascinating to me is what he says to her about shame. Well, how do you know, Pastor? How do you know she's been shamed? Well, because the primary characteristic of people struggling with shame is that they don't want to tell the truth. Have you noticed that? When Jesus said to her, go call your husband, she doesn't want to come clean about the circumstances of her life. So she says, I don't have a husband. And I believe with tenderness, Jesus says, right, you've had five husbands and the man you're living with now is not your husband. She didn't want Jesus to know the truth about her because of that shame. And she thought Jesus would do to her what everyone else had done to her in her life. So she tries to hide the truth. In part, that's what drove her to social separation. She's at the well at the time of the day where it's hot and none of the other women would have been there. Does Jesus point out her situation to shame her more? You see, this is where most people, I think, read this the wrong way, because I believe this is Jesus' way of saying, I already know all about you so you can come out of hiding. See, to me, that's good news. It's really good to know that there's nothing you can hide from God. See, some people will use this very same story as a way to guilt you, to say, you can't hide from God. You better look out. You better watch out. But the Bible uses this truth in the opposite way. I mean, think about it in your own life. You can't hide anything from God, so why not open your heart to Him? Does that make sense? This is what's happening here. Verse 25, the woman said, I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I who speak to you am he. So this woman, who is rejected by her own people, who is rejected by the Jews because of her race, who is shunned by men because she's a woman, Jesus says, forget all that. Come to me. And so Jesus is revealing this important truth about who he is. And when you receive the truth about Jesus, doesn't your life change forever? So she goes back to the town where she is an outcast, and she tells them all that Jesus, the Messiah, was out by the well, and they needed to come to listen to him. And they followed. They came because of her word, and many people came to listen, and many of them believed because this woman told them the truth about Jesus. She was the first evangelist. Did you know that? Even before the 12 began their own ministries. Which is why, and this is my favorite part of the sermon if you're paying attention, this story's not isolated. This is one of two stories. I love how Scripture does this. God's Word is just a great apologetic, because I just don't believe human beings could have the amazing wisdom as the Word of God is laid out. But it's one of two stories, because you see in chapter 3, there's this long dialogue with Nicodemus. And then in chapter 4, there's this long dialogue with this woman. Now remember, the chapters and the verse numbers were added hundreds of years later, and they're really not part of Scripture. They're just a help to us. But in the original language, they were put back to back for a specific reason, because as the reader, you and I are supposed to compare and contrast. To compare, they're both seeking spiritual answers, aren't they? To compare, they both want to understand who Jesus is. But it's the contrast that we should notice. In John chapter 3, he talks to a man named Nicodemus. In John chapter 4, he speaks to a woman who's not named. In John 3, Nicodemus initiates the conversation. In John 4, Jesus does. He's Jewish. She's Samaritan. The conversation with Nicodemus was secretive. In other words, it was in darkness. But with the woman, it was out in the open in the noonday sun. He doubted, at least at first. We know he changed his mind later, don't we? He doubted. She accepts. Jesus tells her explicitly that he's the Messiah. He's never that specific with Nicodemus. This idea of night and day is so important in John's gospel. And John is full of symbolism, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they tell us what has happened. John, using the power of symbolism, tells us why all this happens. This idea of light and dark begins in the very first chapter of John. Look at verse 3. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. But we all know this by experience. You can have two rooms where one is well lit and the other is completely dark with no light source at all. But all you have to do is open the door between the two rooms, and the lighted room doesn't get darker, does it? What happens? The darker room becomes lighter. Why is that? Because light has absolute power over darkness. Darkness can never overcome the light. Isn't that good news? As you read through the Gospel of John, after you have this introduction that Jesus is the light of the world, then you read John chapter 3, don't you? There was a Pharisee named Nicodemus. He came to Jesus by night. And then in chapter 4, Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. And so we see this contrast between light and darkness, night and day. The Samaritan woman is bathed in the light of the noonday sun. Nicodemus comes under the cover of darkness and remains, at least for that time, in spiritual darkness. It's more than just about the conditions of the sky. It's about the condition of their heart. And the theme continues. In John chapter 8, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." In the next chapter, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And then in 13, as soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out and it was night. John's showing us something. Don't miss this. This ought to bless you for the rest of your life. John is showing us that night or darkness is a picture of our spiritual condition. That we have this rebellion that causes us to go to the darkness, but the light will break through that spiritual darkness. And this Samaritan woman has seen the light, and now she's walking in the light. But it doesn't end there. There's yet another parallel that we ought to notice, that there's not just one encounter with the Samaritans. There are two. We know about the Samaritan woman encountering Jesus, but remember, we read about the disciples going into the town to buy bread. They went to Sychar, didn't they? So there's also an encounter with the disciples and the Samaritans in that town. Now, we're only given the details of one of these encounters, but John definitely wants us to think about the other encounter. What do we know? Jesus has a conversation with this woman that breaks through all of this racial hatred. And the conversation moves from asking for a drink of water to talking about living water and talking about Jesus as the Messiah. And John tells us in the other encounter that they went to town to buy food. So here's my question of the day. Do you think that they are doing the same thing that Jesus is doing? Do you think that they said to someone there, hey, we need to buy bread, but let me tell you about the bread of life who is just outside your city gates? And what I'm telling you is I don't think they did. How do we know that? Because of the reaction they have when they come out of the town and they see Jesus talking to this woman. They are shocked. They may have even been ticked a little bit. And so while she's leaving to go tell her community, Jesus says something really specific to his disciples. And I think he's saying the same thing to you and me today. He says to them, lift up your eyes and see how the fields are already white unto harvest. In other words, he's saying, open your eyes because it's right in front of you. And I imagine Jesus pointing in the direction where the woman was going. He wants his disciples to see what they couldn't see. He wants you and me to see what we can't see. That these same people you passed by and ignored, they were ready to respond to the good news. I sent you into the town not just to buy bread, but to tell them about the bread of life. You walked through a ripe field and didn't even realize that it was ready to be harvested. How many of us are guilty of the same thing? Lord, help us. But this woman who just met me went into the town and many of the people there believed. You had the same opportunity, but you couldn't see it. You see, a bruised reed will not break. A smoldering wick he will not put out. Because Jesus taught us in these two stories by example how we care for the broken and the beat down. He shows us how to walk. He shows us where to walk. He's concerned about all people everywhere, every tribe and every nation and every tongue. And so never, ever let matters of race or gender or social status get in the way of showing them the love of Jesus. I learned this early on as a pastor, and the context of this quote I'm about to put on the screen is that when I was pastoring in Plano, there were a couple of church plants, and it was very in vogue back then to send out cards or to put door hangers on people's homes, and a couple of pastors let me know that they weren't targeting specifically these mobile home parks. Because that's not who they were looking for. That's not who they were going after. And that crushed my heart because there's nothing wrong with living in a mobile home. I lived in one for most of my high school age. And it was when I was in that mobile home that I came to know Christ. I'm grateful that David Peterson didn't say, that's not who we're looking for. We're looking for the people with the nice stone on their house. And so I learned this early on because it's who I am, that if you go after the people nobody wants, you'll have a church that everybody wants. That the gospel is for all people, whether you're a CEO or whether you're white-knuckling it through the day because you're not sure if you can stay sober. That's what the gospel speaks to us about. And church, I just think the biggest thing I think we take away from these passages is we just have to open our eyes. Because Jesus is saying, it's ripe unto harvest. And many people might come back to that and say, yeah, but Pastor, you just don't understand how hard it is to reach such and such and such and such again. That is not our job. Our job is not their response. Our job is to simply share the good news. And again, as we've said for many, many years, the man with an argument is always at the mercy of the man with an experience. And you've had an experience with Christ. And if you've had an experience with Christ, that's the answer. And you know, I just think we're so worried about what people might think when what we really need to know is people out there are hurting. Because who's the bruised reed? Who's the smoldering wick? I have no idea, but I bet it's most people.